I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect, practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents, ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha ram, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratna Mandam Puzamega Samudra Saparana Samaye. Okay, welcome to the teaching tonight on the Sakya lineages, the Sakya school. The Sakya school is sometimes called Pal Sakya, which I believe means glorious Sakya. So why is Sakya called glorious Sakya? Well, we're going to explore that tonight, the vastness of it, for one thing. Because it's so vast, the history can sometimes get a little bit complicated, and so I was asked to simplify it this evening, make kind of a simplified version that's understandable of the history of this vast school or lineage, which is quite ancient. In order to do that, I consulted some sources. One source was by the Gongma Sakya, the Sakya Trichen. He wrote rather brief but interesting history of Sakya. A more complete history was written by Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche, who was one of my gurus, passed away not too long ago. And in his history, which was more extensive, he quoted more than a dozen sources that he used. So there's quite a bit of history that's been written down over the years about the Sakya school. And then the third source was Lama Jampa generously consented to many hours of oral history transmission over the weeks and months. So those are the three sources that I've used to make this consolidated version of the history. The question might be asked, well, why bother? Why even study this? Yeah. And there's a couple of reasons. This center, particularly, Lama has emphasized that teachings that are done here are authentic teachings. These are authentic Sakya lineage teachings. These days, that's not always what we find between the internet and, you know, things that are online and various teachers. Sometimes things get diluted a little bit, and there might be some question about whether it's authentic or not. So Lama wanted to have a center where people could come here if that's what they wanted, was authentic teachings, and be sure about it. And so by studying the lineages, actually, we can see that more clearly, that these teachings have come down. This is ancient wisdom that's come down over the centuries, and it's still maintained today, if that's what people want. If they don't want that, there's all these other places. But in addition to that, as I was kind of wrapping up my sessions with Lama with the oral history, he said something interesting. He said, you know, this is not just history. This is the path. I think what he meant was that over the years, there are many, many, many masters who have followed these teachings in this path and attained enlightenment. And so by seeing what they've done, we have a model that we can follow, knowing that these are authentic teachings and that this is an authentic path. So those are some reasons about why we might want to study the history here. We're going to be talking tonight about actually several lineages which have, over the history, over the centuries, have come together into the current Sakya masters that are still alive and teaching and practicing today. The first lineage that we're going to talk about is called the lineage of the clear light gods. So what is that? In Buddhist cosmology, there are different realms. They can be divided different ways, but basically there are three realms: the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. So we are in the desire realm, and that's where we have the six subdivisions with the animals and the various spirits and so on. And then there's the form and the formless realms. Those are celestial realms where we would call them gods live. The form realm, gods have a form, they have body, they wear clothes. The formless realm, gods, because they're formless, they don't have bodies. They exist as spirits or mind or whatever, but without bodies. These are realms that are attained through very advanced meditation practices done incorrectly. And so you end up there. It isn't really where you want to be. And so the beings that are there, in some senses, are very advanced, but they've taken the wrong exit off the freeway, so to speak. And then when their karma expires, then they are reborn somewhere else. So in this three-part division, the desire, form, and formless realms, we have the formless realm was inhabited a long time ago by three Buddhas who went there, because Buddhas emanate in all the different realms to help beings, and they went there to help the formless realm beings. Even though they were Buddhas, they manifested there, they emanated there. And there were three brothers. And because they were Buddhas, they had the Bodhisattva motivation, and at a certain point, they came to Earth to help beings here. Specifically, they came to Tibet. Now, this is a long, long time ago, and we're not really sure of the year, but it's what we would call maybe like ancient history. So these three brothers came to Tibet to help the beings in Tibet, which a long time ago was apparently was a really wild place. Wild people and wild demons and all kinds of spirits running around. And so they brought their benefit to Tibet. And at a certain point, the older brother and the younger brother went back, and the middle brother stayed in Tibet. And his name was Yuring. Yuring married or mated and produced offsprings, and there were five generations of those offsprings. And that lineage is called the lineage of the clear light gods. So that's the first lineage that originated. The fifth generation son was called Yapang Khye, and Yapang Khye had a son called Kyur Barkhye, which means born in the midst of enmity, and I'll explain why he was named that. So there were lots of spirits and demons running around Tibet in those days, and Yapang Khye fought one of these demons and defeated him and took his wife as his wife. They mated and had the son Kyur Barkhye, born in the midst of enmity, or as Sakatrichan translated it, as simply conflict. So Kun, the Kun family, which still exists today, Kun means conflict, or it refers to this conflict, to this fight, where the Yapanke defeated the demon and took his wife. Kyobarke, the son, born in enmity, had a son named Kun Palpoche, and he ended up being an important minister to the king Trisong Detsen in the 8th century. Trisong Detsen was a very famous and important historical figure for the transmission of Buddhism from India to Tibet. There were various waves, and he was responsible for one of the major waves in the 8th century. So Kun Palpoche, the minister, had a son named Kun Nagarachita, who was very famous for two things. Nagarachita was one of the 25 main disciples of Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava was another very important figure in the transmission of Buddhism from India to Tibet. He worked alongside of King Trisong Detsen. And Nagarachita was also famous because at that point in history, and we're talking about the 8th century here, Buddhism was starting to become established in Tibet, but the Tibetans were still considered pretty wild. So the Indians weren't sure whether they could handle being monastics or not, because there's all these rules and vows you have to keep and you have to behave, and Tibetans were kind of wild. So they said, well, maybe they can do it, maybe they can't, we're not sure. Let's do a test. So they selected 7 people, which are called the monastic probationers, and Nagarachita was one of the people chosen as a test trial run to see if they could keep the vows and the rules of everything. Of course they did, and so the monastic tradition was established then in Tibet. Nagarachita was one of those. Now, from Kun Palpoche, there were 10 generations further down until we get to 2 brothers, Sherab Sultram and Kunkhochil Galpo. And those 10 generations are known as the Kun paternal line. So that's another one of these lineages that's come down. Now, the 2 brothers, Sherab Sultram and Kunkhochil Galpo, because originally the Kun family, they were disciples of Padmasambhava, then therefore they were what's known as the Nyingmapa, or the old school. So that was the first school, the first lineage that was established in Tibet from the transmission that arrived from India. But then later on there was a second wave of translations and texts and teachings that arrived from India called the Sarma, or the new school. And even though the Kun family, they were part of the old school, these 2 brothers got interested in these new translations and these new practices that were arriving, the Sarma. And Kun Khochil Galpo particularly took up these practices and said, well, these are really good, we want to include these. And so he founded a temple in Sakya in Tibet in 1073. Now, I say temple because sometimes in books you see it written that he founded the Sakya monastery, but that's technically not correct because they weren't monastics. The Kun family were all what are called householders. They had families, but they were gurus and lamas, but they were married. The monastic part of the Sakya school didn't come until later. So what we normally call the Sakya monastery was really the Sakya temple. It became a monastery later. And the pictures that we see now of the big, big Sakya monastery in Tibet, that came even later still. In any case, Kun Khochil Galpo built this temple. And at that point on, the lineage became known as the Sakyapas. Sakya means white earth, which refers to the hill over the town of Sakya, which was where the name came from. So Tsakyapas is like the people of the white earth. That's what Sakya means. And still to this day it's called Sakya school. Today the Sakya school is known as the lineage of three excellent names. So we have the lineage of the clear light gods, the Kun paternal line, and the Tsakyapas. So those are the three excellent names which are given to the Sakya school. To go into a little bit more detail about the Sakya Kun family, there are what are considered five founders of the Tsakyapa. Interestingly, Kunkunchob Gyalpo is not counted as one of the five founders, even though he built the first Dharma Center. His son, Sachin Kungan Ningpo, who is in that tonka there, is considered the first founder. He was considered to be a Chenrezi Buddha emanation who accomplished Manjushri, and that's partially because he's known because when he was 12 years old, he was sent into retreat by his guru to do a Manjushri retreat, the Wisdom Buddha. And while he was in the cave doing the retreat, Manjushri appeared to him and gave him the famous four-line teaching, the parting from the four attachments. And Manjushri actually spent a month in the cave with Sachin Kungan Ningpo, kind of like his roommate. They had meals together, and he gave teachings, and he gave the commentary on the four-line teaching. That teaching still exists. It's a very famous teaching. We did that here not too long ago, actually. It's one of the famous mind training teachings, parting from the four attachments. Sachin Kungan Ningpo is now considered to be an emanation of Chenrezi and Manjushri. Sachin Kungan Ningpo had four sons, two of which are counted in the five founders. So one of them was Sonam Semo, and they're around him in that tonka. And the other son was Drapa Gyaltsen. Drapa Gyaltsen is a very interesting character, I think, because, first of all, he was a vegetarian in Tibet in the 12th century, which is not easy. And he was a layperson. He led the whole Sakya school as a layperson. And sometimes there's a story of a famous guru coming from India, because he had heard about him, but when he went to meet Drapa Gyaltsen, he saw that he was just a lay person, and he dressed in rags. He would look like a beggar. And so the Indian guru refused to prostrate to him. He said, "I'm not prostrating to anybody who's not a monastic." Drapa Gyaltsen was doing his practice when this person arrived to meet him. And he had the bell and Dorje there that he was using in his practice. And when he saw this guru, of course he knew who the guru was, because he himself was a Manjushri emanation. And he had the bell and Dorje, and he didn't put them on the table, he just suspended them in the air to greet this guru from India. And when the guru in India saw that, he thought, well, maybe he is somebody. And then he prostrated. So that's one of the famous stories about Drapa Gyaltsen. And there's many others. So those are the second and the third founders. And then Drapa Gyaltsen had a nephew, the famous Sakya Pandita, who's in that tonka, who was the originator of the monastic lineage in Sakya. He was the first ordained monk, ordained by the guru who refused to prostrate to him. So at that point, then the monastic part of the Sakya school started. Mm. Today, there's both. There's both monastic and non-monastic. Okay. Sakya Pandita is also this large statue here, Sakya Pandita. That gives you an indication of his importance to the Sakya school. Very, very important. The very first Pandita in Tibet. And He did all kinds of things, including going to Mongolia. Now, in those days, the Mongolian Khans pretty much ruled the world, at least Asia anyway. They had a vast, vast empire, which they conquered with their horsemen, horse riders, storming off of the Mongolian plains into China and Tibet and all over the place. And the Khan heard about Sakyapandita and said, oh, he's the best, well, I want him. And he summoned Sakyapandita from Tibet to go to Mongolia. Now, in those days, when the Khan summons you, you went. So the very next morning, Sakyapandita got on his horse and headed off to Mongolia to be the guru of the Khan. And Sakyapandita took his nephew, Jugyapakpa, with him, who was only 12 at the time. It took him a couple years to get to Mongolia, because first of all, it's a long ways, and they were on horses, but also they stopped along the way, and Sakyapandita was famous, and so they gave teachings and empowerments and various things on the way through Tibet to Mongolia. But eventually they arrived in Mongolia, and Sakyapandita became the guru for the Khan. There's lots of stories about various tests that were given to prove that Sakyapandita really was accomplished and so on. Those are interesting stories. Sakyapandita actually ended up passing away there. He never made it back. Although, to pacify the Tibetans who were complaining that he had left, he wrote Clarifying the Sage's Intent, which is a very famous teaching, sent it back to Tibet. After Sakyapandita passed away, his nephew, Jugyapakpa, took over spiritually speaking, but the Khan also passed away, so there was a new Khan and a new guru, the new Khan being Kublai Khan, you may have heard of. And so Jugyapakpa became the guru of Kublai Khan, and he also was put through various tests, and interesting stories to be read there about what the tests were and how he passed them, but he did pass them. And to reward Jugyapakpa, Kublai Khan gave Tibet to Jugyapakpa. So Jugyapakpa became the civil ruler of all of Tibet as a result of that. And eventually Jugyapakpa passed on the rulership, and the Sakya school ruled Tibet for about 150 years after that. So they were the spiritual leaders and the civil government, so to speak. At that time, the Gelugpa school had not been founded yet. The Kagyu school had just kind of gotten going, and the Nyingmas, according to Lama Jampa, there really weren't very many of them. So for quite a period of time, the Sakya school dominated the Dharma in Tibet. And the teaching spread from Sakya all throughout, and there were literally thousands of Sakya monasteries, and the influence was fundamental, and all of the schools were influenced by the Sakya school. For example, Tsongkhapa's main teacher was a Sakya. And that's true for other schools too. So the influence that Sakya had for a period of about 150 years was almost complete in Tibet. From then, the Khun family was passed on by what they call the bone lineage, which means it's a paternal line. The maternal lines are called blood lineages, but in any case, generations were passed on in what are called podrongs. A podrong, I believe, is translated as palace, if I'm not mistaken, and it refers to the royal families. There were many, many of these lines over the centuries that developed. At a certain point, they also contracted, because maybe there was no son born, so the line stopped. So the many, many lines over time ended up being just one line called the Tuchu Labdrung. And so now we're talking around the 1700s sometime. That particular palace then split into two. The Droma Podrang and the Punsog Podrang, which still exists today. The Droma Podrang is His Holiness Sakyatrizin and his sons. And the other, the Punsog Podrang, is Dakshin Rinpoche and his sons and grandsons, which is in Seattle. So one of these Podrangs is based in India and one is based in Seattle. And those, they're cousins, basically, if you want to look at it that way. And the Sakyatrizin, the Gongma, the head of the Sakya school, it kind of alternates between those two families. I say kind of because it isn't strict alternation. Sometimes they skip a generation. Sometimes there's reasons. And sometimes the rules change about how it's transferred back and forth. And just recently, like a few years ago, the rules were changed again. Instead of just being back and forth between the two cousins' families, they've set up a system which is actually going back to the original system that was a long time ago, which is the way it works now is that whoever is in the Kun family, one of these two families, there are certain requirements they have to meet in order to be eligible to be the head of the Sakya school. So, first of all, they have to study philosophy a lot, years and years, and learn past tests in philosophy at the Sakya College or some equivalent school. Then another thing they have to do is they have to be able to lead a certain ceremony, the Vajrakilaya ceremony, which lasts 8 days, including elaborate dancing and so on. And this is a lineage that goes all the way back to Padmasambhava in the 800s that's been done every year by the Sakyas without break, still to this day. One of the requirements that you have to meet if you want to be the head of the Sakyas, you have to lead that 8-day ceremony from memory. If you flub up and you need help, you can ask for help, but you're deducted 5 points. So these young, they're called Dungses, they're not only studying like crazy philosophy, they have to do a massive amount of memorization to pass this test. Another thing they have to do is they have to complete an 8-month retreat, a very difficult retreat, a Hevajra retreat, which is not easy. There's a lot of requirements in the 8 months they have to meet. So you have to do all these things, and if you pass all the requirements and you become eligible, then you get in line and it's assigned by age. So as it turns out, the Sakyatrizin has two older sons, and so they became the 42nd and the 43rd. But the 44th will probably be in the other Podrang from Seattle, Avikrita Rinpoche, because he's now passed all the tests and he's got married, he's ready, and so he's lined up, and actually should have been this year, but this year is astrologically unfavorable, so they didn't do it this year, but he's in waiting, so to speak.
What's his?
Avikrita Rinpoche.
Oh, he's the one with all the YouTube videos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
Yeah, he's very talented artistically.
Okay, so he's going to be the next one?
He's in line, and, you know, as long as everything plays out, yeah. And then he has a younger brother, and then there's grandchildren, and, you know, it goes down. So stay tuned for how it goes. But usually it's a 3-year term. When COVID hit, that term got extended to 5 years because of COVID, but you know, you have circumstances sometimes that come into play, but this new system, which is the old system, was agreed upon by the two Podrangs, and there was a signed statement signed by the two leaders and published so the public knew what was going on. Both of those podrongs still exist today. So that goes on for like 1,000 years. So that is the Kun family itself. The Sakya school also has what are called subsects. There's the Norpa subsect, founded in 1429 by Norchin Kunga Sangpo. And he was prophesied by the Lord Buddha himself in the Sutra of the Root of Merit and in the Sutra of Spiritually Favoring. Norchin Kunga Sangpo was a great... Actually, he was a Buddha emanation, but he was a great yogi. He could do incredible miracles, raise the dead, and do all kinds of things. And he was a very important historical figure who... They're still part of the Sakya school, but they have specialties in ceremonies and in practices and empowerments and so on. So that's the Norpa subsect. And there's another one called the Dzongpa, founded in 1464 by Dzongpa Kunga Namgyal, who was another great master. And that lineage is smaller, and I happen to have some personal contact with that lineage because I went to the Sakya Monlam in Lumbini, which is a big prayer festival that lasts 15 days, and all the monastics face each other. There's the altar up here, but the monastics face each other, and then the public's behind them. And the foreigners in the public are taken to the front. So I was sitting in the front with the foreigners across from these high lamas. I didn't know most of them. I knew one or two who they were. But there was one young lama there that for 15 days I sat across from him, you know, we're saying the prayers. I didn't know who he was. I found out later he was the head of the Dzongpa. Dorje Denpa is his name. And I thought, geez, too bad I didn't know who he was. I might have said hello or something. I don't know what I would have done. But anyway, I found out later. I was living in Europe at the time. I went back to Europe. And then shortly thereafter, I found out that he was going to do a 3-week tour of Europe. So I went, oh, great. This is my chance. So I flew to England and met him. And as soon as I heard him teach and I was around him, I realized this is a... Even though he's a young lama, he's a very important figure and an important teacher. So for 3 weeks, I followed him around Europe, getting various teachings and empowerments, some very rare Dzongpa empowerments, because Dzongpa subsect was kind of small to begin with, and then the previous reincarnation of Dorje Denpa was killed by the Chinese communists defending the Dalai Lama when he escaped Tibet in 1959. So the Dzongpa lineage kind of got extinguished. And so the new reincarnation was discovered in India. He was actually born in India as a 12-year-old boy. He was discovered. And his job was to rebuild the subsect. So he was collecting the empowerments and the transmissions from the lamas that still were alive, that still had them, so that he could collect them all. But he was also giving them out because he wanted the Dzongpa to survive. So we ended up getting a whole bunch of really rare Dzongpa empowerments and teaching in Europe that were hardly even known in India. So that was just a kind of a personal story about the Dzongpa subsect. And then there's the Sarpa subsect, founded in the early 1500s by Tsarchin Loso Gyatso. Another Buddha emanation, great Maha Yogi, Maha Siddha. And again, they have certain specialties. For example, the Vajrayogini practice is one of their specialties. Also, it's good to understand that Tibet is a big place. If you look on a map, you know, like you superimpose it over Europe, for example, it's like, you know, the size of Europe or something. And we're talking about the 1400s here. They didn't have Wi-Fi then. They didn't even have telegrams. They didn't have communication. So a lot of these situations were just simply geographic, that a great master would appear in some far region, and then the lineage would develop, or the subsect would develop in that part of Tibet. So you get sort of regional developments in these subsects. So geography was another factor in all of this. And these are all very famous great teachers who have done all kinds of great things, written texts and commentaries and so on. And then there are some sakyas that don't belong to any of these subsects, like Lama Jampa. Sakya. They're all sakya, but some sakyas are members of the subsects. That's a discussion of the subsects. Then we have another lineage in sakya, which is the Lamdre lineage. Lamdre is translated as path with the fruit. So this is a very famous sakya practice, and this one is a little bit different in how it comes about. The Lamdre is a very high Vajrayana practice. And the Vajrayana practices were taught by the historical Buddha, but not to everybody. They were only taught to people who were spiritually mature enough or ripe enough to receive it. When the Buddha taught the Vajrayana, he didn't teach in the form of the historical Shakyamuni Buddha that walked around India 2,600 years ago. He took the form of the tantric Buddha, which is Vajradhara. Vajradhara is in that tanka. It's kind of small, but you can't see him. But anyway, Vajradhara taught the Hevajra Tantra, and the Hevajra Tantra has a consort named Nairatmya. So Hevajra is the deity, Nairatmya is the consort. Back in India, there was a very famous university called Nalanda. It was the big scholastic, one of the big scholastic Buddhist universities, and the abbot of that university was called Dharmapala, known these days as Virupa. And Virupa practiced the Tantra at night in his room, and he taught the sutras during the day in the college. But his practice was secret, and he practiced for a long time, and he thought that he didn't get any results. So he thought, oh, well, maybe I don't have good karma with this practice. Forget it, I'm not going to do it anymore. And he took his mala and he threw it in the latrine. That night he had a dream, and Nairatmya appeared to him in the dream and said, "You shouldn't have done that. That was a mistake. I am your goddess. I will help you. Go get your mala, wash it, perfume it, and I'll teach you from now on. I'll be your teacher." So, Virupa, by the way, he's known as Birwapa in Tibet. Anyway, Virupa went, got his mala, did what he was supposed to, and every night for the next 6 nights, Nairatmya appeared to him and gave him tremendous blessings. And if you know anything about bhumis, he went up the bhumis every night. He went up one bhumi to the sixth bhumi and became a very, very high master in less than a week. And he continued to practice secretly in his room, but the dakinis, the female deities, would come into the room at night with him when he was doing the practice. Well, females are not allowed in the monastery at night. I mean, that's just a rule. And so the other monks would hear things going on in this room, and they'd peek through the crack in the door, and they would... Some monks who were really highly advanced saw female deities. Some just saw women. So the word got out that Virupa had women in his room at night, a lot of women, and that's not allowed. So he got reported, and he got in trouble. And he said, no, that's okay, I'll leave. And that's when he changed his name. So he just, at that point, he was a high Mahayogi. He was beyond. So he said, okay, no problem, I'll leave. You have your rules, that's fine. So he took off his robes, folded them up nicely, put them at the doorstep of the monastery, and he left naked, went, grabbed a bunch of flowers and radishes and stuff, and made an outfit. And he became one of these sort of mad yogi types. And there's lots and lots of stories about what he did, but he was not mad. He was just highly evolved. And some of these Mahasiddhas did rather strange behavior. That's not unusual. So he was in a different category. But he became the Lamdre lineage holder with all of that. He passed the Lamdre on, because this is all passed on, you know, from guru to disciple, and so on and so on and so on. And he passed it on to Kanha. Now, Kanha is the name that Chogi Trichin's history used, but Lama Jampa insisted that the real name should be listed as Krishna. Now, that's not the Krishna which is the Indian deity. This is another Krishna. This is a yogi named Krishna, who started out as a Hindu and ended up converting into Buddhism and became a Mahasiddha in Buddhism and became the recipient of the lineage of the Lamdre. So Krishna then passed it on to Dhammarupa. Dhammarupa passed it on to Avadhuti. And Avadhuti passed it on to Gayadhara. Now, in this chart, the Indian gurus are horizontal, and then when it gets to Drukmi Lhotsawa, it switches over to Tibet, and now those are vertical, just to make a visual distinction here. So Gayadhara was one of the main yogis who brought the Lamdre over the Himalayas, so to speak, into Tibet, and then Drukmi Lhotsawa, Lhotsawa's translator, translated it into Tibetan. So these are the two of the main historical figures for this transmission over the mountains from India into Tibet. And then from Tibet it went down to Satan Kunrik, Shangtung Chobar, and Sachin Kunkha Ningpo. Remember him? Sachin Kunkha Ningpo we met previously as the first founder of the Sakya school. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of a roundabout journey that the Lamdre lineage made until it arrived to Sachin Kunkha Ningpo in Tibet. However, when Sachin Kunkha Ningpo received it, he was given the instructions to keep it secret for 18 years. He couldn't even say the name to anybody, so nobody knew that he had it. He practiced it, of course. But at a certain point, he became really ill, and he lost his memory. Now, the Lamdre was an oral transmission. There were no books. So when he lost his memory, he lost the Lamdre. So he was up the creek, so to speak. However, Virupa, the originator, of course, being clairvoyant, knew all this, appeared in a dream to Sachin Kunkha Ningpo and said, don't worry, I'll give it to you again. So for 3 months he came and transmitted the Lamdre again to Sachin Kunkha Ningpo and reestablished the lineage. And at that point Sachin Kunkha Ningpo thought, I better write some of this down. And he wrote 11 commentaries on the Lamdre. And since then, there have been other great masters that wrote commentaries. But the Lamdre lineage, and then from then on, it was passed on guru to disciple, and so on and so on and so on, down to the present day. There are Lamdre lineage holders who give the Lamdre. I've received the Lamdre 3 times myself. It's a very long, elaborate transmission of everything. Practices, philosophy, all kind. It's a very complete practice, very high practice. And the Sakya school is, it's one of the things the Sakya school is famous for, is the lamdre, the path with the fruit. There is a part which is available to the public, and then there's a part which is secret that you have to go through the empowerments and so on to do. But the public part, we've actually taught here in this center a couple of times. And there are, you know, textbooks around it and so forth. So that lineage still exists today. The Kun family lineage still exists today. The paternal line and the clear light lineages were absorbed into these other lineages. And so in a sense, they still exist within the other lineages. So that is a simplified history of the Sakya school and how it arrived from outer space to Victoria. Comments, questions, complaints?
Yeah, I got a question. Was the Gayadhara, was he Tibetan or Indian?
Gayadhara, I believe, was Indian.
He's Indian, okay.
But that period of time, there was a lot of back and forth, and there were a lot of people learning, you know, languages so that it could be not only transmitted, but transmitted correctly.
So Gayadhara was a translator too?
Well, I'm not 100% sure what his linguistic levels were exactly. I assume he knew some, but I don't know how much. Drukpin Lhotsawa, on the other hand, Lhotsawa means translator. Mm-hmm. So he's for sure on the Tibetan side translating. But very often these people worked in teams, you know, to get both sides of the fence, so to speak, and the nuances of the words and the language and so on.
I noticed that in the beginning it was a family lineage, like, and did that continue on, or is it just disciple type thing?
Are you talking about Lamdre or the Kun family?
The Kun family.
Kun family lineage is a family lineage, and that still exists today with these two, the one in Seattle and one in India. They are Kun, their name is Kun.
And it's a family passed down father to son?
Yeah.
And their wives, do they, like the royalty, go out and find particular lineage with them? I mean, is it like inbred, like the Habsburgs or something? Or is it...
It's not inbred.
Just wondering.
It's not, no, good question. It's not inbred. They don't call them wives, they call them consorts,
right.
Which I believe they use that term in England too, don't they?
Yeah.
But they are from outside, so to speak. They're not inbred. But they are arranged marriages.
The world is.
It's interesting to see who gets picked. For example, the 42nd Sakya Treason, his consort was not even a Sakya. Her family were Gelugpa, and she went to university in the U.S. She went to art school, art college in Kentucky. So she's fluent in English, knows all about the internet, and, you know, modern woman, you know, and knows all kinds of languages. And I've met her. She's just wonderful, wonderful person. Was very kind to me on a couple of occasions when I needed a favor. And then they have their children, and they're all Kuns. She's not a Kun except by marriage. And then the same thing is true with the 42nd's younger brother, who is now the 43rd Sakya Treason. His consort is a Tibetan woman who's actually from Switzerland, who was a Nyingma, who was not a Sakya. So the consorts don't have to be Sakyas, but they have other qualities. And I haven't met her, but seems like a totally wonderful, you know, person. She was a professional singer, and they now have a family, and those kids are all Kunz. So that those families continue. And then the Seattle family, they're younger because they're actually grandchildren. So the Avikrita Rinpoche, who will be probably the 44th Sakyatrizin, he just got married. He's, I think, 30. I've seen a picture of his consort, but I don't know anything about her. But eventually we'll probably find out some more. But those are arranged marriages.
And does it go to, like, the eldest male, or just the male that seems appropriate, or how does that work?
Well, there's these prerequisites that I mentioned earlier. Yeah. They have to do the 8-month retreat. They have to do the years and years and years of philosophy college. They have to do the 8-day ceremony for memory.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's any other requirements, but I know that those are some of them.
Yeah.
And then it goes by age.
Okay, so ability trumps age.
Well, you have the prerequisites to be qualified, and then once you get in the lineup, you go by age.
But they don't just, every boy has to do all this stuff, and then it's a race from there.
They don't have to do it because, for example, Sachin Kunga Ningbo, he had 4 sons, but only 2 of them became lineage. They went on and did other things. They weren't just lying around watching Netflix all the time,
right.
But they weren't part of the lineup, so to speak.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
I thought you were going to ask me, do the daughters get a shot at it?
Well, yeah, I didn't hear that. So
well, I'll ask the question.
Okay.
I don't know, and I'm not sure we know yet. And I say that because there is a daughter, there are daughters now,
mm-hmm.
and the daughters are now being educated, you know, in long, long, long time ago. That didn't happen so much.
Right.
So they have shown flexibility in the system. It's not rigid. And the oldest daughter is, I guess, about 16, so it's a little early. Because you usually have to do about 10 or 12 years of philosophy college, so it isn't usually till around 30 years old that we're talking about having finished all the requirements. So I don't know how it's going to play out. Be interesting to see. However, she sits on the thrones like all the boys, and she's there at all the ceremonies and all the empowerments and all the events. So it appears that she's in the system. But we'll see. I don't know. She's got to do the requirements first, of course.
Yeah. How about the progeny of girls? Is it just the progeny of boys that is eligible to become eligible for this?
Well, again, I'm saying from my understanding of it,
right.
There's the bone lineage and the blood
lineage.
The bone lineage is paternal. The blood lineage is maternal.
Right.
This is a bone lineage. So I'm assuming it's only on the male side.
Okay. And only their progeny.
That's my assumption, but again, I could be corrected by a scholar at some point. That I don't know.
It's just interesting.
And then there's Tempi Nima. Holy nun, right?
Tempi Nima, there are very famous and highly accomplished females historically. Tempi Nima is one of them who is a lineage holder in another lineage, the Vajrayogini lineage. And she actually was the teacher of 4 of Sakyatrizins who were all males. So historically, she was a giant figure. And there's others too, the various chondros and historical figures. You know, we're prisoners of culture. 1,000 years ago, things were a little different than they are today. And one of the things is that if you were born a prince in a royal family, your birth date and your name and who your parents were and who your family was all written down in the royal records. That didn't happen so much for the daughters. And so they were there, but we don't know so much about them. We do know some of them and some about it, but Tempe Neame is probably the best example.
There's a really interesting book written right on the subject called, what is it, the one that was written about all the aunties who were all yoginis in the sake, and they actually wrote a book, and Tempe Neame was actually the teacher of all these yoginis in the Po Chang Palace, like before the Chinese invasion.
Yeah.
It was really interesting because out of all the schools in Tibetan Buddhism, the Sakya is probably the least. There was more opportunity for women to advance in their spiritual, position than in any other of the schools. I don't think they're saying a lot, but
yeah.
How about Kuan Yin? She was a Chinese Buddhist, right? And was
she was a goddess.
Yeah, Kuan Yin is. She's on the altar here somewhere.
Okay.
Is the Chinese Buddha of compassion.
Right.
See, the Buddhas are gender fluid.
Right.
They're not tied down so much like we are.
All right.
And so,
yeah.
She's female in China, she's male in Tibet, but also Tar, who's female, came from Chenrezig, who's male, so they're not bound by any kind of, things
that
we're bound by so much. It has to do more with their quality than it does their gender.
Right.
You know, like Tar, for example, is action. You know, she's got one foot up in the statues because she's ready to go. If you call her, if you make a supplication, she's there. Like, and she's green because that's the color of the air element, which moves quickly. It's the quickest element, you know.
Right.
So it's symbolic too. It's
right.
Depending on what you're talking about and what the activity is, then the form takes a certain shape and color and gender and all that. Going back to the historical side of this, nowadays there are a lot of scholars, mostly women, who are researching female historical figures and digging up documents and finding out about these people, these women, and writing about them, and there's books being published. We have one of them here, which is a summary of the Sakya women.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the book I was talking about.
Yeah.
I can't remember the title, though.
Yeah, it's up here. We can look at it afterwards.
Yeah.
And the professor who researched it and wrote it has gone online and given talks. I've heard a couple of her talks online. It's really interesting, subject. And they've managed to dig up lots and lots of information. But it takes some research, and that's what people write PhD dissertations about and things like
right.
that. But it is coming out, and, whatever was there is being rediscovered or discovered and made public. So I think probably as time goes on, there'll be more of that,
I didn't know that Kuan Yin was the female Buddha. I had always heard Kuan Yin was born from the tears of Buddha, or something like the compassion.
Yeah. Tara, it was same thing.
Ah.
Buddha born from a Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's an emanation of compassion, of activity, mm-hmm. active compassion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the archetype, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Manjushri's wisdom. Vajrapani is power, they're out there, but they're also in here.
Exactly, yeah. That's why they're so compelling, right?
Yeah, and images are also something that humans relate to in a certain way, and color too.
In aspects.
Yeah.
The aspect that they stand for.
Sarah Harding, was that the author of that book? Finley?
It doesn't ring a bell.
Anyway, we'll look afterwards.
Yeah, it's a great book if you're interested in that
subject. And there's others too. There's a Nyingma, a Kadro, a Dakini, a female yogini who I've studied with some who lives in Iowa. And she's a lineage holder. I mean, she's a throne holder, recognized teacher. I mean, there's plenty of them around. if you look.
Yeah. Huh.
Any other comments?
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up by doing our dedication prayer. We'll do the English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, Samantabhadra, know how to transfer merit. So do I dedicate all my own virtues, that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained, prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.